Next, we have Dr. McKinstry. He's going to speak on MR imaging of brain development.
I have no disclosures relevant to this. Some of you may recognize me from a Siemens TV commercial. I'm not going to be presenting any of those data in this. And I did one day of consulting for Gerbe around a contrast agent. None of that is relevant to this presentation. How many of you here are from the MTV generation? All my analogies are going to be rock and roll, and there are a few of you. Okay. Do you know the Right Here, Right Now video by Van Halen where they zoom out and you see the whole world spinning around? That's me. We're in a satellite right now. Okay, so all you really need to know, you've kind of heard already. The brain contrast inverts. So if you just focus on the frontal lobe, let's see if I can do this. The answer is apparently not. I can't see a red thing. I can't see red. I can't see. So if you focus on the... it won't go backwards. There it goes. If you focus on the frontal lobe, at birth, the gray matter is brighter than the white matter on T1, and it's darker than the white matter on T2. And if you look at the teenage brain, the contrast reverses. That's all you need to know. The other thing you need to know is that, just in general terms, myelination proceeds from bottom to top, back to front, and inside out. Really, that's all you need to know to be a neuroradiologist. So let's drill down on that just a little bit. So why is that? As you've heard repeatedly, you know, repetition is good for learning, and you're going to certainly get a lot of repetition in this lecture. The brain weight increases fairly dramatically over those first 2 years of life, just like you just heard. And while that's happening, the fraction of water content drops. Water is the key determinant of T2 signal. So if water content drops, then the signal on T2 weighted imaging will go down. And the converse of that is that the lipid content goes up, and cholesterol, which is part of the myelin sheath, the lipid in the myelin sheath, increases over those first 2 years and continues. You can see it's a much more slowly varying function. That increases over those first 2 years. That makes the T1 signal bright. And here are actual values. Now, as T1 shortens, meaning as you move from left to right in this graph, T1 shortening actually makes T1 signal brighter. I can explain the physics later if you'd like. And the difference between the gray matter and the white matter curves is contrast. So you can see there's very little contrast at birth, and if you really drill down on that part of the graph, it's actually reversed depending on where you are. And on T2, we see the same general trend in the relaxation times. They fall. But on a T2-weighted scan, a falling relaxation time causes the signal to become darker. And again, the differences between gray matter and white matter in these curves is contrast. And you'll see at birth, the contrast is actually reversed. So to kind of refine what Dr. Gilmore was just talking about, and Dr. Vanessa, all the lectures really, right? So in a 26-week preterm newborn, we have lobar anatomy. But the opercula, the portions of the frontal, parietal, and temporal lobes that cover the insula, are not yet well formed. So the insula is uncovered. The Sylvian fissure is wide open. You can actually, as you heard about the germinal matrix in the subventricular zone, I can't point, but if you look right on the wall of the ventricle on the bottom row, you'll see there's some black dots. Those are actually germinal matrix hemorrhages, and you can imagine that's going to impair the subsequent migration of those precursor neurons that are supposed to head out to the cortex. And you also see some dependent black signal in that bottom row in the second image on the left. That's hemorrhage into the ventricular system. So the brain has a very smooth lissencephalic contour, but it's not lissencephaly. I like 30 weeks as a kind of a seminal period in brain development, because the orbital frontal regions show no gyration or sulcation at 30 weeks, but by 31 you'll start to see invagination of the sulci. So I can pretty much tell when the brain is 30 weeks and 31 weeks based on that. You'll see that the opercula are starting to form, the Sylvian fissure starting to form, and the insula starting to be covered, and each individual gyri is starting to form. By 34 weeks, you can see that orbital frontal region, which is pretty much in the top row, second from the right. You're starting to see individual gyri there now in that orbital frontal region. The opercular well forming now. The Sylvian fissure is fully developing. So this is that same Jason Hill compendium that you heard from Terry Ender, Jeff Neal, and Dave Van Essen's collaboration. You can see initially the Sylvian fissure is wide open. You see lobar anatomy, but no gyri. As we move from past the 31 weeks, you can see individual frontal lobe gyri in the orbital frontal region. And as David has already pointed out, a preterm newborn brain at term looks different than that of a term newborn and looks different than that of an adult. And that's one of the things we do as pediatric neuroradiologists is as we get a term-adjusted scan prior to discharge from the NICU, and we score it exactly the way you've heard. At term, the key determinant is the posterior limb of the internal capsule. The parts on T1 that are myelinated are the dorsal medulla, dorsal pons extending towards the dentate nuclei, the midbrain, dorsal midbrain, the cerebral peduncles, and the posterior limb of the internal capsule. You'll also notice from David's myelin map, you can pick out where the perilandic cortex is. It's on the bottom row on the right. The brightest cortex there that's kind of in the anterior third, that's the perilandic cortex, which has greater density and more myelination even at term. Generally, the rule is if you look at T2, it's 3 months behind T1. So the key determinant there is that the posterior limb of the internal capsule here is very weakly myelinated, and that's how we're going to establish brain age. Is at term, you should see the posterior limb internal capsule on T1, but not on T2. And again, if you look at that bottom right-hand image, you can see that very dark cortex is that perilandic cortex. Increased density, increased cell size, as you heard, increased myelination, all contributing to shorter T2. So this is one study from the MRI study of normal brain development, which we did last decade, funded by multiple NIH institutes and performed at multiple centers. But this just happens to be one child to illustrate that if you look at a T1-weighted image, the T2-weighted image will look roughly equivalent, the flip side, you know, flipped contrast, but roughly equivalent 3 months later. So on that first scan, which is 3 months of age, you can see the posterior limb of the internal capsule and some myelination in the optic radiations. And we don't really see the subcortical occipital lobe regions myelinated on the T2 until about 6 months. And in general, that's all going to be true, and that helps us to nail down the brain age. At 2 years of age, as you heard already, we say that brain has an adult pattern. Usually, I say that when I teach our residents that, we say that's on the canonical slice at the level of the internal capsule. But if you go down, if you look at the upper left-hand image, that's not true in the orbital frontal regions, as you heard, the temporal poles and mesial temporal lobes. Those areas are not mature at that age. So in general, the attainment of the adult pattern is complete by age 2, but if you look at specific areas, it continues on, as I'll show you. And the T2 has somewhat of an adult pattern. I'll like to convince you that over time, the cortex looks like it thins, and the white matter gets blacker over time, and that's as myelination progresses. Now, this is cross-sectional epochs on different visits from different children averaged together. So here you can see, this is from the MRI study of normal brain development again. At birth, the major determinant there is the posterior limb of the internal capsule, which is white. Then by age 3 months, you'll see the optic radiations on average are myelinated. The anterior limb of the internal capsule is a 4-month determinant, and it's starting to weakly myelinate, but the genu of the corpus callosum, which is our 6-month marker, is not yet myelinated. And then as you average 6 and 9 months together, you see you pick up that anterior limb, you pick up the genu of the corpus callosum, and you pick up the frontal polar projection in the superior frontal gyrus. And then as we move out towards 4 years, it looks very different. But not only the association areas myelinated, but in general, the cortex looks thinner. The boundary between the gray matter and the white matter is much better defined because the subcortical eufibers are myelinated. As you heard, the intracortical projections have myelinated, and there's probably been some pruning as well. So after age 2, picking up where the last lecture led off, it looks like a normal brain at age 2, but if you really drill down, that's not the case. So here, these are averaged about 6 to 12 subjects per range here, 3 years, 6 years, an adult. and you look at that subgenual and orbital prefrontal cortex, the gray-white differentiate is very indistinct. The intensity of the myelination in the white matter is pale. And then as you move towards the adult region, you'll see that that's progressively maturing. Same with the mesial temporal structures. And over and in general, the gray-white differentiation gets crisper, and the cortex appears to thin, at least on images. As you've already heard, diffusion is a marker for development. What we found is the cortex of the developing brain, for all the reasons you heard, is very radially organized initially, and then as the laminar structure and the dendritic connections become much more complex, we lose that laminar structure, we lose that radial structure until the anisotropy or the directional preference of diffusion falls to the noise floor. As you heard, a lot of these white matter areas are already present at birth, and if you look at the bottom right image, these are very old images, as you can tell, but you can see the optic radiations were present, and there was robust myelination in that occipital pole, even at term gestational age. So if you take the combination of diffusion T1 and T2, you can pretty much nail down the age. This just confirms that graph that I showed you at the beginning. The brain is drying out. And the other key thing to see here is that the gray matter and the white matter end up with the same diffusion coefficient as you approach adults. And over time, as you've already seen, there's progressively, these data are 15 years old, there's progressive increase in the amount of myelin. And what I want you to do here, see, myelination is stepwise on anisotropy. When you lay down the scaffold, you get one level of anisotropy. When you lay down the lipid, you get a second level of anisotropy. And when you squeeze out the water, you get a third level. So as we move along, just focus on the posterior limb of the internal capsule. You'll see it'll get thicker and it gets brighter. Okay, so let's see what we can do here. The brain age. So I'm not going to be able to point to structures, but if the posterior limb of the internal capsule on T1 is 3 months, the optic radiations, or is zero, excuse me, 3 months is the optic radiation, 4 would be the anterior limb, 6 would be the genu of the corpus callosum, and if you had that frontal polar projection, that would be 9 months. So it's between 6 and 9 months. Let's see what we got here. That looks like a very old brain, just for the sake of time. It's very hard to make to determine that once you've hit 12 months, 12 to 24 months is very challenging. You need to have a lot of experience to do that. So here you can see the frontal polar region, I think, is myelinated on the T1 but not on the T2. And indeed, that pretty much nails down that the time is between 9 and 12 months. Here we see only the posterior limb of the internal capsule. That means it's at term. And this is just to show that the chemical makeup of the brain is also very different as not just the structural makeup. That's a spectroscopy. So here we are again. That's a pretty old brain. Don't know exactly how old it is, but this one turned out to be a year. Here we are a little bit in between. We're done. How long have we been down?
Just for a second.
Okay. So, all right. For the sake of, I think we can be done. It's just you can see, I made my point. By the way, this was another rock and roll reference while I'm killing time here. What's my age again? What's the reference to? Anybody in the room know that one? No. Blink 182 is the right answer. Good job. All right, still no slides. All right, well, you get the idea that when I sit down and read a scan, I look at its gyrification, I look at its myelination, and I try to establish a brain age, and then I find out the adjusted gestational age, and we can do some things like determine if there's myelination or maturational delay, injury. All right, so, yeah. So just to summarize it then, if you sort all those in order, there's roughly a three-month delay between the signal on T1 and T2. At term, it's the posterior limb of the internal capsule. At 3 months, it's the optic radiations. At 4 months, it's the anterior limb of the internal capsule. At 6 months, it's the genu of the corpus callosum. At 9 months, It's the frontal polar projection of that superior frontal gyrus on T1. Then you switch to T2. That frontal polar projection on T2 is 12 months. Between 12 and 24 months, you're on your own. We have to have a better way of doing it. Maybe myelin mapping or something can help us nail that down. So that's the satellite view of what's going on, and that pretty much wraps it up. Thank you for your attention. Thank you, John, for putting this together.
Thank you, Dr. McKinstry. We have time for some questions. Again, if people could use the microphones. I've got one right now.
All right.
So this pattern of myelination, the middle to front and down to up, so if there's a timed global insult in infancy, are there known disconnection syndromes or behavioral consequences that result, say, a concussion at the time that things are going this way or that way, et cetera?
Absolutely. So in perinatal hypoxic ischemic insults, the key determinant of neurobehavioral outcome is how robust the myelination of the postulinum internal capsule is. It's really the only marker we have at that age, but it turns out to be a pretty good predictor, not only of cerebral palsy, but of cognitive impairment. Likewise, we actually were the first to describe that following an injury, you see these early signs of Wallerian degeneration on diffusion, and the white matter tracts that are going to degenerate become really bright on diffusion, and subsequently there's volume loss and lack of myelination. So absolutely, there's a brain behavioral correlation with the lack of those lack of those normal developmental processes.
Question over there.
Hello. Hi there. I'm just wondering if you could expand on the difference between cortex and cortex, right? So you're calling cortex the difference between gray matter and white matter, right? But there's also the cortical layers, right? And the axons enter and exit at different levels and have a different degree of myelination. And over time, the myelin will invade the cortex, and early on, it won't even approach the cortex.
So. Absolutely. And, ever since we started the MRI study of normal brain development, we've been arguing that because the idea of pruning was what was the common thought as to reason why the cortex was going to be getting thinner. But as you pointed out, if the subcortical U fibers aren't myelinated, you're just going to see a better boundary. Now, from image processing, you have to define it some way. So we define it mostly as these contrast boundaries between what's bright on T1 and what's dark on T1, but that's not necessarily a one-to-one. So I feel your pain, and I don't know exactly how to get at that. Maybe David can help us figure out how to get to that that final answer as to what's cortex and what's white matter.
Other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. You had one slide with spectroscopy, and then we kind of missed the second one because of the technical difficulties. So my question is, does the spectroscopy follow the same pattern where by around age 2 it's...
Excellent question. So if you go back, here's at term newborn, roughly the choline peak, which is the tallest peak on the left, is roughly double the size of the area of that of the NAA peak, the choline being the marker for myelin turnover, and NAA being marker for neuronal density.
Right.
So over time, you see the NAA grow, and you see the choline peak drop. And that does that regionally, just like white matter myelination proceeds, and it does it temporally. So as we move on forward in time here, if it'll go forward in time, you can see roughly at this age, depending on exactly where you interrogate the voxel, you'll get here the choline and the NAA peak are equal height or area, and then as you move towards a more adult pattern, you get what's classically described as Hunter's angle, where each peak gets progressively taller. So yes, it follows exactly the same progression at a different, the time of onset is not exactly the same, just like it isn't for T1, T2, or diffusion, but it follows the same temporal sequence and that follows the same topographic progression.
Thank you.
One more, if it's very brief.
Yeah, I might have gotten more out of the talk if I knew what T1 and T2 was, and I didn't understand the brain anatomy.
Those are unfortunately chemical and physical properties of the proton. So when you put a proton in a magnet, it aligns with the magnet. If you perturb that in away from its equilibrium position, there are two relaxation times that determine how it gets back to equilibrium. One of them is the rate at which it grows back in alignment with the magnetic field, that's T1, and one is the way the signal decreases in the XY plane, or perpendicular to that, the direction of the magnet, and that's T2. I can show you some educational lectures afterwards if you'd like. It's unfortunately a 13-week course at MIT if you'd like to.
Thank you very much, Dr. McKendry.
Okay.
Thank you. And next we have Dr. Fair, who's going to tie all of this together and stimulate some discussion and some questions. Okay? Take it away, Damien.
All right, thanks. So I only have one disclosure here. While I've been on several panels where discussants are present, this is the first time I've actually had the opportunity to actually be the discussant. And so, last night, as I was looking at folks' slides and trying to, think about what we would talk about today, I went online to look at what the role of a discussant actually should be. And I was a little surprised to see, some of the very aggressive, really pointed, harsh critiques of all of the, panel members, that some discussants actually do when they're doing this. And then I remembered, David Van Essen was on my thesis committee and a very active member of my dissertation defense. And undoubtedly some of the other reviewers here have been the, reviewer number three on some of my papers. And so I just can't thank, John enough for allowing me to come here and offer my thoughts about some of the talks that we described today. So I'm essentially going to outline three or four, four basic bullet points that I think would be good for an educational discussion that, hopefully can generate some more discussion if there's time. So the first thing I'm going to do is give just a brief framework of how we might consider some of the findings that we're talking about today and considering the developing brain, and then ask just some three, difficult questions that I think are important for this audience. One question is what actually is a typically developing brain? Another one is, how do the dynamic processes that occur from conception to birth relate to the remaining developmental course that was examined in some of the other pieces? And as folks have been discussing here a little bit in the talk, this is quite difficult. So the question of why don't we just test it is, I'll try to touch on some of that as well. Okay, so the framework for considering, typical development. So this is a famous diagram regarding the different levels of inquiry when we think about the developing brain by Church and Sajanowski that's really lasted across the ages. So the first level of inquiry, we're thinking about very small spatial scale molecules, things that all the events that are occurring what's inside the cell that are allowing it to function properly. With regard to the nervous system, at the next level, we're thinking about, synapses or how the chemical interactions that allow for different neurons to talk to each other. At another level, we have the actual neurons and the dendritic trees and the axons and the whole morphology of a given neuron. In this case, we think about networks as more of kind of in the order of cortical columns, or collections of neurons and different types of neurons that integrate to form a functional unit. The next level is maps, which Dr. Van Essen touched on a little bit, and that is how these collections of units can come together to form kind of distinct areas in the brain. The example of V1 here that you see here in the red is an example of a specific functional area. Then another level of systems where those areas kind of come together to form specific networks. You're to things like a default network and other types of networks. And then, of course, As we get larger, it's this very large-scale topology that that is very intricate in how we might examine. So this is the spatial characterization that I think is important framework for us to think about some of the findings that we looked at today. And then there's, and of course, this is all together. This stuff together comes to some very complex behavior that we can see in our over a course of development. This is my Don King impression of my little girl. So the other aspect, the other piece of the framework that we have to really consider, and I get to steal a slide from John Gilmore, and trying to think about, you know, the relative timing of all these types of events that are going on, this interaction between the genetics and the environmentally expectant nervous system that eventually develops over time. And the last part for our framework is to think about, and this is also modified from this Churchin-Sagnowski paper from 1981, think about all the different types of measurements that we have at our disposal to actually measure the phenomena that we wish to examine in the brain. And some of these measurements are not created equal. On the axis, this axis up here, you know, we're looking at the spatial resolution of a given measurement that we can obtain. On this axis over here, we're looking at its temporal resolution. And so some measurements have bispatial resolution and low temporal resolution and vice versa. So all these considerations are really important if we're to think about, you know, how we're able to understand the developing brain and what it means, what these findings mean with regard to how the system's functioning. All right, so our first question, what is a typical development? So in David's talk, he talked a bit about individual variability and specifically with regard to cortical convolutions. This is something that our laboratory has been thinking about quite a bit, and I was happy to see him talk about this. And in short, what he's noticing and noted is that there is a tremendous amount of individual variability depending on where in the cortex you've been. Of course, he wasn't the only one to talk about variability or heterogeneity. So we talked in John Gilmore's talk, we were able to hear a lot about how there's quite a bit of variance that occurs from birth to age 2. In fact, one of the things that kind of popped out at me in one of his slides was that if you look at the surface area of a given 2-year-old relative to an adult, the range of across those infants goes from 22% of the adult all the way up to 170%, meaning that there's lots of variability with regard to some of these particular measurements. And some of the earlier talks when Candace was describing some very basic things like neuronal migration in very famous slide here, is that we even see a lot of variability even at these very earliest stages. So one of the questions is, well, what is the functional relevance of this variability? What does it actually mean to the functioning of the system? And for the purposes of this talk, what is it, you know, how does it inform, how may it help us inform atypical developmental trajectories? And the other question that I want to propose is that, is it possible that the variation across all these features that we are examining doesn't necessarily fall along one just, you know, continuous dimension? And this is what I mean by that. So if we take, let's say, the cortical folding patterns in the frontal cortex, and we look across all your participants, what you might see is just kind of a nice normal distribution of, you know, similar versus, or, you know, folks at the very end of the spectrum, mostly people in the middle, just a nice normal distribution of this particular pattern. If we add another feature, let's say the variability in the temporal cortex, you might see again another very kind of normally distributed pattern. Okay? But if you combine these particular features and look at them together, is it possible that there are kind of unique populations that exist in what otherwise looks like just this normal, relatively normal distribution? These are things that my laboratory is very interested in thinking about and trying to elucidate to some extent. Now, in the case of clinical populations, the idea that there might be these subpopulations in the populations that we study that is very heterogeneous is not new. And typically when we examine studies like kids with autism versus those without, we take the kids with autism, just compare them with those without, and the assumption of the particular model, of course, is that there does not exist any heterogeneity in the sample. It presumes that everybody in your sample is all the same. Like I said, it may be that there's multiple populations across these dimensions that exist in your population that would be quite informative to how you study the disease process. Now, I study ADHD, and we do some work in autism, and yet this idea in clinical populations is not new. But the model also presumes that typical development falls along one continuous dimension as well, right? It may be that even within our control populations, there are these homogeneous subprofiles or subpopulations that exist. And so the other question here is, well, is it possible that some of the variation that we observed across in some of these studies and across these features in typically developing populations is embedded in these kind of discrete subpopulations, meaning it's a multimodal distribution, not necessarily single modal. And underneath this population variance, are these trajectories important context for understanding developmental disorders like autism? So the second question here that I think is important for the group in considering the findings that we saw today was, how do the dynamic processes from conception to birth affect the remaining developmental course? So we saw some very, Candace presented some really important work on how on cell migration in the early prenatal periods and differentiation in cell processes. And of course, you want to know, how do these processes relate to all the different findings that we're beginning to see with these non-invasive measures in the later developmental period? What's the relation? And why is it important? Well, there's a nice paper that just came out on autism in the New England Journal of Medicine by Korshain's group that has showed that some of the pathology, at least in a subset of the population, the kids with autism, is related to these very early developmental periods way, way before that we ever can obtain any of the information information that we're obtaining with some of these non-invasive measures. So it's really, really important to determine how these two, the phenomena that occur here, relate to the phenomena that occur here. But why is it, of course, that we don't just test it? Well, the problem lies in the methods. The methods that we have at our disposal. And I'm going to put one more layer of complexity on this slide here. And now we're looking at methods and this temporal and spatial resolutions here, but now the relative invasiveness on the z-axis here. And what this is telling us is that the methods that are very non-invasive that we can use in humans are much different than the methods that we can use in animal models that describe a lot of the prenatal phenomena that we're used to seeing. And so they're segregated. So I'm just going to move on here to make sure we have time. So in other words, we have these complex behaviors that we typically examine in human models with some of these non-invasive measures. Then we have animal models that give us some information about the detailed biology. There's a need for some of these bridge measurements to look at information across the model types. And John Gilmore was talking about functional connectivity and development of functional connectivity in the early periods. Well, now there's methods now to use the same measurements that we get in humans in these very discrete animal models, all the way from the mouse to the macaque. On white matter integrity, Bob McKinstry was discussed a lot about changes in white matter integrity. Well, now we have tools at our disposal to begin to examine white matter integrity based on specific manipulations that exist in various animal models that we can link, again, directly to the biology. This is likely important. Cortical thickness, we talk about, and density. John talked about a lot of that work. And again, we have, there are very specific animal models now, and the measurements we have with MR can act as a bridge across these and to get, see how the underlying neurobiology relates to the outside. So I'm going to end there and allow some more discussion. Again, I think it's some thinking about these different levels of inquiry is an important framework for considering typical development and atypical development. And then I'll just leave these questions live. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Damien. So we have time for some questions. Again, if people could use the mics, they could ask Damien some questions. They could ask us. We may ask each other some questions, and we want to just stimulate some interactive discussion. So, okay. Dr. Gilmore may have to leave soon, so if there's a first question for him.
Hi, Ephron is media at NYU. What is the relationship between myelination and synaptic elimination during this period? I mean, is the myelination induced synaptic elimination, or is there any kind of causative interaction?
There are some provocative hypotheses that myelin suppresses synapse formation. I'm less familiar with any evidence relating to elimination per se, but the idea that regions that are high in myelin content within the gray matter where the synaptic action is occurring, of course, may be less plastic, and regions of low myelination may be more plastic. There are a number of studies that I consider intriguing. It fits with the idea that the low myelinated, quote, higher cognitive regions ought to be more plastic because that's where the learning action needs to occur. So whether that's a correlation or a mechanistic meaningful interaction that relates to synapse formation and or elimination, I think is very important for as an issue, but hard to tease out in any definitive way.
Yeah, just to add to that, there are studies that show that myelination in the cortex will close. There are studies that show that myelination in the visual cortex is associated with closing of critical periods. So it probably does have something to do with it, but yeah, it needs to be studied.
Someone at the mic?
Yes. Excuse me. I'm a clinician, and first of all, just a comment that I found it really interesting. I yesterday saw a set of identical twin girls who one of them has autism, really pretty autistic, and the other one is pretty normal. And the folding in the areas that's different from individual to individual, even in twins, is really interesting because I never understood why I saw, you know, this such big differences sometimes. The question that I have is, are what, you know, the panel is saying that it's even more important to make the diagnosis early and get even therapies, just, you know, change if it's, that might be the most plastic time to change things in those first 2 years, where neurologists are very reluctant to make a diagnosis, say, before 3 years, that it's in that year number one, year number two. If you could recognize abnormalities and then intervene, that what you guys are arguing might be the most, that's the most important time.
I can go ahead and start with that one. So in my clinic, I want to diagnose autism spectrum disorder as early as I possibly can so I can triage kids to intervention. The hope of what we're doing with brain imaging studies in autism is to see if we could develop markers that would allow us to do better risk assessment prior to the expression of autism-specific symptoms. Now, this leads to one question that we could all talk around the table here. What's coming out of research? Because studies are being done comparing high and low risk subjects with respect to the future development of autism against controls. other studies. Dr. Gilmore works in schizophrenia. Other people are looking at ADHD. And the question is, what is the specificity of these findings? For instance, if we're finding a difference in individuals who subsequently develop one disorder versus controls, is that specific to that disorder, or is that just a general marker for neurodevelopmental abnormality? And leaving open the question of how specific an intervention would such a difference warrant. So I think we have a lot to do, and I don't know if others. One more.
Hi, I work with a group that studies NICU graduates, and we've published some of our data indicating, first of all, higher risk of autism in this population, but also evidence for what looks like atypical brainstem development. And my question is, what is the role of brainstem input on cortical development and cortical folding?
Can I just ask for clarification? How do you know it's not top down rather than bottom up?
Well, I'm talking about it in terms of measures of auditory brainstem evoked response. So at that level, there were
because certainly we know that your graduates have many of them have sustained either obvious or sub-radiographic white matter injury, and so certainly the descending pathways are impaired.
Yeah, they do. These are individuals who on ultrasound don't have any obvious pathology. So to the extent that the ultrasound is efficacious, they don't have MRIs, though.
Right.
So that's an issue. Yeah.
So, but as you know, some of these kids that graduate, and as they have their term MRI on the way out the door, even though they never had obvious white matter injury, their white matter and their gyral pattern is not normal.
Okay.
So, yeah, no, but it's a good question. I don't have the answer. Maybe do you have anything to add?
Nothing data-driven to add strongly, I think. But I think the general point is, you know, someone like me who focus on cortical organization, we always need to be mindful that there are powerful influences from these tiny numbers of cholinergic, adrenergic neurons that are modulating neural signaling in profound ways and in normal, healthy operation. And what that might be doing during early development is hugely important, even if it's another of the hard to actually tackle. We should not forget about that as a possible explanatory component.
Thank you.
We have time for one last question.
Sorry, I would just pursue that a little bit further. The cortical subcortical connections, what is the role of those in the tension-based theory of folding? Abnormalities in cortical subcortical connectivity have been found in autism and various other.
First of all, the number of connections is considerably lower. But, you know, one way of, I tend to think of it is that if in morphogenesis you need something to tether the cortical sheet to the underlying white matter and subcortical structures, and so. If you have a bunch of balloons that are being tethered by being anchored to subcortical structures, that's part of morphogenesis. Essentially, Darcy Thompson a century ago articulated these issues for development in general of plants and animals. He didn't think inside the skull, but if he had, he would have captured this idea that morphogenesis is the interaction between pressure and tension through the entire collection of elements that are one is trying to watch unfold or fold.
We're supposed to end around 12:15, so if anyone wants to stick around and individually ask questions of the speakers, they're welcome to. But let's please give a round of applause for all of our panel speakers today. Thank you for your attention.